The man blamed for the death of Kennedy, Lee Harvey Oswald, was born and raised here in the city. In fact, just months before the assassination, Oswald was in New Orleans handing out pamphlets and other propaganda supporting then-Cuban dictator Fidel Castro. Castro was a known enemy of President Kennedy. In fact, WDSU did one of the last known interviews with Oswald before the assassination about his motives in support of Castro.
And then there's Jim Garrison, the Orleans Parish District Attorney. During the time Kennedy was assassinated, Garrison led his own investigation into the president's death with the theory that Oswald was not the lone shooter and that members of the mafia in New Orleans conspired to that kill the president. There's also Clay Shaw, a New Orleans businessman and the only person prosecuted in the assassination of Kennedy. Garrison pressed charges against Shaw, saying he conspired with the CIA to kill Kennedy. However, Shaw was acquitted during a one-hour jury deliberation.
This is Failed State Update, and I am Joseph L. Flatley. Today's interview is pretty darn good, if I do say so myself. We're speaking to Fred Litwin, the self-described former conspiracy theorist and author of On the Trail of Delusion, Jim Garrison, the Great Accuser. This book is important to the canon of JFK conspiracy theory research. Even though it's going to be rejected out of hand by a lot of people in the JFK research, assassination research community, because it really exposes the lies and, quite frankly, craziness of Jim Garrison. Now, Jim Garrison was the New Orleans district attorney who sought for years and years and years to prove that there was a conspiracy based right in his city that brought down JFK. First, it was a gay conspiracy, and then when that didn't wash, it became a military-industrial complex conspiracy. Wherever you stand on the subject of the JFK assassination, whether you think it was a lone nut or a cast of thousands, fact of the matter is that Garrison was a crazy homophobic nut. And it's great to see someone like Fred Litwin did so much work and, you know, original research and dug up documentation to really just tell this story about how one man with a little power and a chip on his shoulder and really an obsession can create so much confusion and really set back the cause of JFK assassination research years. And it's really quite a remarkable book.
My name is Fred Litwin, and I live in Ottawa, Canada, and I've been researching the JFK assassination since 1975. When I was 18 years old, living in Montreal, I saw the Geraldo Rivera show back then, where he showed the Zapruder film, and I was horrified, and I decided I had to go find out what exactly was happening, and that led to decades of research. At first, I was believing in a conspiracy, and over time, I changed my mind. And so 2 years ago, I wrote my first book on the case called I Was a Teenage JFK Conspiracy Freak, which is a memoir that sort of goes through why I changed my beliefs. And my current book is On the Trail of Delusion, Jim Garrison, the Great Accuser.
We're discussing things like talking about the JFK assassination. It should be a matter of just talking about what happened, what's provable or not provable, and coming to a conclusion. But for a lot of people, it really is more about belief. How much does belief, do you think, play a role in how we see these conspiracies? And with something like the Kennedy assassination, is it ever really possible to know the truth?
Well, I think a large part of this is definitely related to belief, and the Kennedy assassination is almost your Rosetta Stone of conspiracy, because it allows you to see whatever it is you really want to see and then work backwards. And so a lot of people, instead of understanding what happened, they go, well, why was he killed? And they'll find their particular pet theory. Okay, he was killed because he wanted to break up the CIA and they hated him, and so they had to kill him. And then you go find the data to support that. Or other people might say, well, he wanted to get out of Vietnam. He was going to change the foreign policy of the United States. And so he had to be killed. And so you see a lot of that. And people start with that question of why. They move work backwards and they find everything to that fits into their particular theory. And you see that very strongly with Oliver Stone, who, because of his the fact that he was in Vietnam, he served in Vietnam. Vietnam is very important to him, and he used the Kennedy assassination as a vehicle to get across his views on American foreign policy.
So your book, at least the beginning, concentrates on two gentlemen, Jim Garrison and Clay Shaw. The JFK conspiracy idea has become such a part of society that I think a lot of people don't really understand where exactly it came from, or the fact that where it came from was so problematic. And I think Garrison's a great example of that. If you could just tell us who Jim Garrison was and how he plays into all this.
Well, Jim Garrison was the district attorney of New Orleans in the 1960s. And he was elected on a sort of a reform platform. And he was very ambitious. And so once he took office in 1963-62, he really began to go after a variety of political interests in New Orleans. So he took on the judges, he took on the police, he took on the legislature of Louisiana, he went after the governor. He went after everybody and generated a lot of headlines. And it became known you didn't really want to cross Jim Garrison. But what he also did was he discovered that there are a lot of unused powers in the district attorney's office that he could use. And so he decided to use some of these powers. And one of his favorite things to do was to subpoena people to appear before the grand jury, have them testify about something, of course, in secret and also without a lawyer. And then he could basically go and he would charge them with perjury. And this caused them great hardship because they would have to get a lawyer. They'd have to spend money. It's a felony charge. And so they could not even leave the parish without permission of Jim Garrison's office. They couldn't get bank loans. They couldn't get a mortgage. And so people became frightened of Jim Garrison because that's a lot of power. He also had the power to get people to appear in his office for questioning. And he also had the power to indict people on his own for any non-capital offense. He could indict somebody with a stroke of the pen without going to the grand jury. So he had a lot of power. Where it all started to go wrong, in particular, was that he decided, I guess he was bored in the fall of 1966. He started reading Rush to Judgment and other JFK conspiracy books. And he went down the rabbit hole with disastrous consequences.
So Garrison was portrayed by Kevin Costner in Oliver Stone's JFK. But the real Garrison was far different than Costner's portrayal, wasn't he?
Yeah, well, he was, you know, I mean, look, he was a very smart man. He could think on his feet. He had a very, very good sense of humor. He could quote Shakespeare. He had a deep, booming voice. And so he was very appealing on television. He made a fantastic interviewee. I mean, he really was fun to talk to. And Louisianans, people in New Orleans in particular, like to be entertained mm-hmm. by their politicians. And that's what he did. He really entertained them. But at the same time, he was terrorizing a lot of people.
He was kind of a showboat, though, right? He would, like, even before the Kennedy assassination, he was known for these kind of ridiculous cases that he would take on and really was trying to drum up, like, publicity for himself, it seemed.
He was always in the press. You can go back and check the New Orleans Times Picayune, and you'll see almost on a weekly basis there would be some new controversy with Garrison where he would go after somebody, generate some headlines, and then nothing would really happen. But he got the headlines, and you know, that's what he was after. He was very ambitious. I think he wanted to be either governor of Louisiana or he wanted to be a senator.
He's so important to the JFK assassination research community because he kind of laid the groundwork for, like, what the overall plot's going to be. Can you tell me what that is and kind of how he got to that conclusion?
there was a very important link in the assassination in that Lee Harvey Oswald lived in New Orleans for 5 months prior to the assassination. And in fact, in 1963, Garrison was involved in investigating two leads that came out of New Orleans. So when he went into this whole issue again in 1966, he knew that if there was a conspiracy, maybe it was incubated. Maybe the genesis was in New Orleans, and he already had a couple of leads. So it sort of made sense for him to go back and reinvestigate the two leads from then and see where it went. The problem for Garrison was that both of those leads went nowhere, and so he ultimately had to invent the evidence.
How did that play out? How did he go about inventing evidence?
Well, he was smart. I mean, there were two leads, and so one lead was this lawyer Dean Andrews, and on the weekend of the JFK assassination, he was in hospital with double pneumonia. He was under heavy sedation. And he claimed that on the Saturday before Oswald was killed that he received a phone call from a Mr. Clay Bertrand who wanted to hire him to go to Dallas and represent Oswald. And so the question was, who was this man, Clay Bertrand, who tried to hire Dean Andrews? That was one lead. The second lead was on the weekend of the assassination, there was a former Eastern Airlines pilot by the name of David Ferry, who was doing some investigative work for the lawyer of Carlos Marcello, who was a mobster. And on the Friday night of the assassination, he drove to Houston, Texas for a weekend with two friends. And one of his enemies in New Orleans started calling up the FBI and New Orleans police on the weekend saying, that guy David Ferry is involved. He knew Lee Harvey Oswald in the Civil Air Patrol in the 1950s. He knows guns. You should investigate him. And so those were the two leads. And Garrison looked at both of those leads back in 1963. And they went nowhere because Dean Andrews could not identify Clay Bertrand. And David Ferry was completely innocent. He had just gone on a fun trip to Houston for the weekend.
You use the word, he uses the word, and you kind of describe it a little, propinquity. Is that a real word? Was that even a real word?
It's a real word, and it's a very interesting one. It's one of Garrison's, he had a theory of how he investigated crime, and it was the theory of propinquity. And propinquity, it's a great word. Propinquity basically is people who live near each other. Or it could be coincidence of other types of coincidence, like two people are homosexual, something like that. But if he believed that two people lived near each other, they might be connected. And so Garrison was always looking at city directories and looking at different blocks. And so if Lee Harvey Oswald, when he lived in New Orleans, lived on the 4900 block of Magazine Street, Garrison would look at who else lived on Magazine Street. And if somebody's uncle lived on the 5,000 block of Magazine Street, then they were linked to Lee Harvey Oswald. And so he was looking for links, and people in the office thought he was crazy, but that's what he did.
Yeah, I think you offered one example. It was like, I'm probably going to get this wrong, but it was like somebody lived in an apartment that David Ferry owned, which was like near something else that... of somebody who knew Lee Harvey Oswald or something. So like the idea was that Clay Shaw must be connected to Oswald.
Yeah, he wrote two memos on propinquity listing all of these sort of coincidences. And he also wrote other memos with other propinquity items. And it was bizarre. So, you know, if you ate at a restaurant across the street from a suspect, then you were linked. And that's what he was looking for. And it went. He would investigate the people who lived on an entire block, every single one of them, because one person had some sort of linkage. And you find these memos, and of course they all went nowhere. But that's his craziness.
Was Garrison mentally ill, or like how was he off? I guess is my question.
In many ways, but he. in the 1950s, he was discharged from the military for psychiatric problems. And they did a psychiatric workup on Garrison, and they said that he was severely incapacitated for civilian life. And he went to see a psychiatrist for a while. So there were certainly some issues back then. But I think the larger issue, and one that I raised in my book, and we don't know, but was Garrison perhaps a repressed homosexual? And did he perhaps take out some of that repression on Clay Shaw, who was another gay man in New Orleans? I don't know the answer to that, but it's a question that's open.
I did an interview with Jim Hogan, who's a investigative journalist who knew Norman Mailer when Norman Mailer was writing about, you know, investigating and writing about Oswald. And I also talked to Lawrence Schiller, who was like, who worked with Mailer. Yeah. And this was like, I was just going down this rabbit hole like 4 or 5 months ago, and I recorded these interviews, and then I thought, well, I'll just wait until November and put them out. And it's just like, just happens to be coincidence that I discovered your book like last week.
Wow. Can you get in touch with Lawrence Schiller again?
Yeah,
because I'd love to talk to him, and he must have some documents. He was involved in investigating homosexuality back in Garrison's day, and actually there is a memo about him in Garrison's files, which I don't have, but I want to get, and so I'd love to talk to him.
I think I just caught him on the right day, because it was like, I think he's in New York, and they were locked down, and I emailed him, and he emailed me right back, and it's like, I got nothing to do, give me a call. So
right.
But I can kick myself, because I was playing back this interview I hadn't heard since, you know, 4 months ago. And I asked him about the Kennedy assassination stuff. And he talked about how he was in Las Vegas and he got pictures of Jim Garrison with his lover that were, I think he said they were in Life magazine or something. And I'm kicking myself because I didn't follow up on that at all. You know, it just it didn't really mean anything to me at the time. And I'm wondering how much of all of this that we're talking about, whether or not Jim Garrison had some sort of hidden homosexual angle there, or just his kind of how crazy this investigation was that apparent in New Orleans at the time or in Louisiana? Like, were people that were following this stuff thinking that there's something not quite right with Jim Garrison?
There was. And you could see memos written by Aaron Cohn, who was head of the Metropolitan Crime Commission. It's a private group of citizens who were interested in crime in New Orleans. I have memos, many memos from him talking about Garrison's mental illness. And he actually went to a doctor. He went to Dr. Ochsner, who was quite famous in New Orleans. And they had a discussion about Garrison's mental illness. And Dr. Ochsner said he's clearly mentally ill.
Like the propinquity thing, I think I keep getting stuck on that. Because A, it's an amazing word. First of all, it sounds like schizoid affective, just layman's terms, you know, but it's so indicative of how a lot of these Kennedy assassination researchers operate. It's really telling that something that's impacted so many people's lives has really come from something as weird as, you know, Jim Garrison's, you know, proclivity for propinquity.
Yeah. Well, you know, look, it's what making connections is one of the things that makes us human. We look for connections all the time. And the problem with conspiracy theorists is that they see something that's really not there. Sometimes they really are conspiracies, like Al-Qaeda taking out the World Trade Center. But, you know, and that was the problem with Garrison, was he was always seeing these connections that nobody else could see. And even when the evidence was really, really clear, he would just go on and as if it didn't matter. I'll give you one example. He fancied himself to be a cryptologist, and he could decipher codes in Lee Harvey Oswald's notebook and Clay Shaw's notebook. And in one famous case, a Warren Commission critic, Sylvia Marr, wrote him a registered letter saying, look, you're off your rocker. This is not true. This is wrong. Here's why you're wrong. There's no connection here. And he called her the next day. He got the letter. He called her on the phone. And it's like he ignored everything in the letter. Did not make an impression on him one bit.
I must imagine that the fact that he was the DA and he had all these powers and he had this budget had just really fed into his whatever his disorder was, and, you know, empowered him.
And it was worse because he not only had his own budget, but he had private funding. So he actually set up an organization called Truth or Consequences of private businessmen, and they funded his investigation privately. That he raised $100,000 back then for his personal private use on the assassination.
And let's talk about Clay Shaw a little bit, because he's one of the more dramatic examples of someone whose life was totally destroyed by Garrison's investigation.
Yeah, Clay Shaw was a war hero. He did a lot of work on logistics and in the Normandy invasion in World War II, and he received medals from three different countries. And he went back to New Orleans, and he was very involved in international trade. And he built, raised the money and built the International Trade Center in New Orleans. So he was very, very famous as a popular, as an important businessman. But privately, he was a playwright, and he'd written several plays, one of which had been performed quite often in the United States. And he liked to buy properties and restore them. And he was quite successful at doing that in the French Quarter, and a lot of his houses were featured in the magazines in New Orleans. So he was very well known and very well liked. He was a patron of the arts, but he was in the closet. He was a closeted homosexual.
So what role did he allegedly play? What role did Garrison claim that he played in the assassination?
Well, there was that lead of Clay Bertrand, the man who supposedly called Dean Andrews to hire a lawyer for Lee Harvey Oswald. And so the question for Garrison was, who is Clay Bertrand? And this Clay Bertrand, according to Dean Andrews, was gay, and he spoke Spanish. And Garrison put two and two together and say, well, Clay Shaw is gay. Clay Shaw speaks Spanish. And he had this belief that gay people, when they use a pseudonym, keep the same first name.
Oh, of course.
And so Clay Shaw must be Clay Bertrand, and that was his theory. And he eventually found a witness who he put under hypnosis and administered sodium pentothal, who put Clay Shaw at the scene of a party where they discussed the assassination.
Garrison's claim seemed to kind of switch from, like, ultimately he decided it was the military-industrial complex that wanted to wipe out Kennedy because he wasn't going to allow them to run amok and keep raking in the big bucks. But initially it was a homosexual plot, allegedly, right? With Clay and a lot of these people.
For like the first couple of months of his investigation, there was Clay Shaw, David Ferry was gay. And then he had this belief that Oswald was gay and Jack Ruby was gay. And he actually told a number of reporters that it was a homosexual conspiracy. Where gay people, these homosexuals, were upset that Kennedy was a virile, straight man who they could never get into bed, and that they had convinced themselves that they had to kill him. And
it's so convenient that, like, Garrison came on this his other angle, and he could just kind of, like, forget that he was saying that, you know?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there were a couple of things. I think a lot of the conspiracy theorists who went to New Orleans to help him out, like Mark Lane and Harold Weisberg, when they heard that theory, I'm sure they told him, look, you got to cut this out because you're sounding a bit kooky. The CIA is a much better target for you than homosexuals.
There was a large community of, I think, predominantly leftist figures, and Ramparts magazine and stuff were all looking into this. How did Garrison kind of fit into that?
Well, there was a whole community of JFK assassination conspiracy buffs who were out there looking at the 26 volumes of evidence. They are writing books like Harold Weisberg and Mark Lane and Sylvia Marr and Richard Popkin and a whole variety of others. Many of them had gone to New Orleans to help out Garrison. A few didn't go, like Sylvia Marr. And so he was he was sort of part of that milieu. What really gets interesting, and I'm really going to go through this in my next book, is that Sylvia Marr, who was one of the smarter critics, didn't buy into it. And she started getting very upset at the other critics for accepting Garrison's nonsense. And in fact, I went to her archives and I put on my blog two memos she wrote about the Shaw trial. And she actually corresponded with Clay Shaw. And she broke off relations with a number of critics because of their silliness in supporting Garrison. She felt it was just a horrible thing that was going on.
And it's really amazing, almost comical, like just what kind of people were attracted to the investigation or dragged into the investigation. One that sticks out, he's come up on my podcast a couple times, is Kerry Thornley.
Yeah.
Which is,
yes.
Why don't you just share his connection to all of this?
Kerry Thornley was a Marine buddy of Oswald's. They served together in 1959 for about 3 months, I think, in California. And Oswald was on his way out. Thornley was on his way in, and they crossed paths. And Oswald was attracted to Thornley because Thornley was an atheist, as was Oswald. And so they discussed politics for quite some time, but they weren't huge friends. But Thornley knew him. And to make a long story short, Thornley, after the assassination, or I should say before, after he got out of the military, ended up moving to New Orleans. And while Lee Harvey Oswald was in New Orleans in September of 1963, so was Kerry Thornley. They were both there at the same time for about 3 weeks. And Garrison got it into his head that Kerry Thornley knew Oswald in New Orleans and started to make up a whole variety of conspiracy theories around him and ultimately indicted Thornley for perjury. It took years of fighting to get that quashed. It was actually completely silly. I have a chapter on Kerry Thornley in my book. It's quite unbelievable. But for a while, Garrison believed that he was an Oswald impersonator.
And how many Oswalds ultimately were there?
That's a good question. Was there two, three, or four Oswalds? I mean, I tell the story of a Garrison staffer, Tom Bethel. And he was having lunch with another JFK researcher, and Bethel was making fun of the two Oswald theory. And the other researcher said, well, no, you're right. There wasn't two Oswalds. There were three Oswalds, and there were two Jack Rubies.
And this was all to explain how these people could be in multiple cities at the same time. And
you know, like any national crime, when you have the whole country interested in what's going on, there's no shortage of people who call up and say, well, I saw Oswald here, I saw Oswald there. And so there were a lot of instances of people seeing Oswald. And of course, most of them were bogus. In fact, there was a report that Oswald was in Montreal, where I was born, in that summer, at a demonstration in support of Castro. And I know researchers here in Canada who have gone crazy trying to get the RCMP to release pictures. And when you actually see the pictures that came out, you know, Oswald was not only not there, but there were like six people at this demonstration. So people saw Oswald everywhere. And of course, so conspiracy theorists said, well, there must be two Oswalds, and that's how we explain it.
Kerry Thornley was, it seems like he was pretty much driven nuts, or at least helped along the way by his interactions with Garrison.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Kerry Thornley started thinking, because New Orleans is pretty small, you know, he actually met Clay Shaw once, although he wasn't really certain of it, but Clay Shaw had owned a building that he was renting from, and he may have been there doing some redecoration. So he may have seen Clay Shaw once, and he saw Guy Bannister once. And, you know, with all the conspiracy theories floating around, he started thinking, my God, I met this person, I met that person. Maybe it is all connected. Maybe I am part of this somehow. And he started going slightly crazy.
And what ultimately happened to Clay Shaw?
Well, Clay Shaw was indicted by Garrison for conspiring to kill Kennedy. It took 2 years for the case to come to trial. He was acquitted after a 30-day trial. And then on the next business day, Garrison indicted him for perjury, two counts of perjury. And that took another 2 years for Clay Shaw to quash. And he then sued Garrison for $5 million in damages. But unfortunately, he got sick and he died of cancer shortly after that.
Did Garrison's investigation eventually kind of peter out? I guess it had to. He lost re-election. So did it kind of just peter out only to be resurrected by the Oliver Stone movie?
He continued the investigation after the perjury charges, and in fact, there was a flurry of memos in his office for the next 5 or 6 months after that. But Garrison had back problems then, severe back problems, and he was out of the office for several months. And at that point in late 1969, the office lost interest, and he lost interest and sort of petered out. And he was also writing a book. He wrote a book in 1970, A Heritage of Stone, which was sort of about the CIA and the assassination. And then he's also fighting re-election. And so there are too many other things. And the whole thing just petered out.
One person that comes up in every time I crack open a book about the Kennedy assassination is Fletcher Prouty. I know he was influential in Oliver Stone. And I just can't, you know, the first time I ever heard of him, I was like playing with a shortwave radio and some like program by the Liberty Lobby, you know, some like anti-Semitic far right wing thing. Like he was like the host of it or something. And I'm just like, or they were promoting him. And I just always associated him with this like really gross right wing anti-Semitic politics. All these like left-wing guys who are writing their JFK books, you know, they always cite him without even mentioning what a horrible person he is or like putting him in any context, which I always just find really odd.
Well, it's really interesting in that Fletcher Prouty worked in the Pentagon and I think some special operations. He worked for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he retired in 1963. Went on to start writing these books, and he was a right-wing conspiracy theorist, almost the forerunner of the Trumpists in believing in the deep state. Mm-hmm. He didn't use the term the deep state, but he called it the secret team.
Yeah,
right. A secret team of CIA military-industrial complex people who were running the country. And here's what I thought is so interesting is that his sort of right-wing conspiracy theories were taken up by Oliver Stone, who was sort of a left-wing conspiracy theorist. It's sort of a marriage of the two. What I show in my book is Fletcher Prouty was working, did a lot of work for the Liberty Lobby, which was a group organized that denied the Holocaust, and a horrible, horrible group. And Prouty's book was published by one of their organizations. And that caught up. Oliver Stone, you know, people started criticizing Prouty when the Oliver Stone's film came out, and Oliver Stone knew about this, and he kept on saying to the public, "Well, look, you know, he may have made a mistake, but you know what? In private life, Prouty is not anti-Semitic. He never says anything anti-Semitic. But I found a smoking gun, and I found an anti-Semitic letter that I publish in my book." That he sent out to another researcher, which is quite damning.
What were the contents of the letter?
The contents, he was warning in the letter about the problems of military technology and the fact that you sometimes have military communication systems in a plane that where you have to rely upon ground people to help you out and causes problems. And his letter says, "What if the person on the ground is Jewish?"
You see that so much in the conspiracy theory realm, you know, these marriages of convenience between right and left, or citing people like Fletcher Prouty or the Executive Intelligence Review, which was like a weird Lyndon LaRouche propaganda arm that like did quote unquote investigations of things.
Well, I think it's really crazy. In fact, the funny part is if you read my first book, you'll see the first article I ever got published back in 1976 was in a small conspiracy magazine, and you could see that I put a JPEG of the index on my first book, and I'm Fletcher Prouty is right there with me with another article. I knew back then it was crazy. He, you know, these sort of huge conspiracies are way too hard to keep secret. I sort of would understand if somebody believed, well, you know, Oswald shot Kennedy and he was communicated with by the Cubans or somebody else and there were a few people involved. I could be talked to with a small conspiracy. But when you get up into the upper levels of the CIA, the military-industrial complex, and they're all covering it up and they're altering evidence, and it just, it's way too big, and I don't think you can remain secret.
Say what you will about evil people doing evil things, you know, but when you start kind of positing that there's hundreds of thousands of people doing it to you all the time and somehow nobody knows, I think it opens you up to like the kind of collective insanity that QAnon is.
I was talking to another researcher, Gus Russo, who is a great researcher, and he was talking to an FBI agent who worked on the Kennedy case in New Orleans. And this FBI guy was Irish Catholic, and he said he loved Kennedy. And he was in tears. He was in tears when he was talking to Gus Russo. He said, I loved Kennedy. I wouldn't cover up anything. I wouldn't do. I mean, I loved the man. And he was in tears because of all the allegations.
And, you know, that's kind of my major critique of these, like, very large, irresponsible, on the face of it, obviously, bizarro conspiracies, is it really reduces people to... It takes away their humanity and it denies, like, you know, the subtlety and the things about us that, you know, are fully human. Like, I did a piece a few years ago about this group of people that think the Boston Marathon bombing didn't happen. They claim that it was, like, you know, special effects and people pretending they got their legs blown off and, like, crisis actors, they were called, and developed this complex theory to explain away this event, like the Office of Naval Intelligence was supposedly, you know, doing psychological testing or something. Completely ridiculous. And I'm looking at, you know, I talked to someone that was there at the finish line and took pictures, just happened to be taking pictures of the finish line when the explosion happened, when the bomb went off. And I just thought, how can you look at these things and think, you know, oh, they're full of shit, or they're making stuff up, or, like, it's just, it's really callous and dehumanizing, I think, looking at the world at this level.
Yeah, it's I mean, I look at the fact that some of the conspiracy theorists now have to make up about how evil Clay Shaw was.
Yeah.
And they're making up all these stories about how evil and horrible, what an awful man he was, and it really obscures the truth about Clay Shaw, who was a really... nice soul who is remembered fondly in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And there's a really nice plaque on Governor Nichols Street in New Orleans for Clay Shaw. This is the problem is that sometimes it's fun to have conspiracy theories. You know, if you believe in the Sasquatch or you believe in UFOs, okay, I don't, you know, it's harmless fun. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the JFK assassination turns deadly. And I think of Carlos Bringier, who was an anti-Castro Cuban in New Orleans, who Garrison went after, and his wife was so worried that he was going to be arrested, she had a miscarriage.
Yeah.
And it's stuff like that that affect people who lost jobs. I actually spoke to Al Boboeuf. Al Boboeuf was one of the people who went on that trip that weekend with David Ferry to Houston. He's now 74 years old. He was 21 at the time. He's still around. He's still alive. And he couldn't get a job back then. Garrison's men were following him around. Every employer he went to, they would go visit. He couldn't get a job because they had tried to bribe him. And his lawyer had the smarts to actually tape the conversation. And there was a whole investigation, and Garrison forced Boboeuf to come down and say he wasn't bribed, sign a statement that he wasn't bribed, because it was the only way he was going to be able to get a job.
Yeah, and you know, you're not just describing, you know, Garrison as somebody who was wrong. You're describing him as, like, somebody who was not beyond using strong-arm tactics to try to push his pet theory, even, you know, at the expense of these people's, you know, their lives and careers, sanity.
And so that's where I really have a problem. I don't have a problem if somebody believes in conspiracy in the JFK assassination. We could have a civil discussion about it. But Garrison ruined people's lives. And that goes beyond, that's not worth it. It's not worth it. And that's what bugged me about Oliver Stone. when he was asked about some of this, he said it was worth it. One man's life was worth it to uncover the truth.
Yeah, that's really just heartless. I have the JFK assassination in like kind of a box, maybe yes, maybe no. You know, like I'm definitely, in the broadest sense, was there more than one person behind the Kennedy assassination? I think there could be.
Yep.
But even as somebody who's sympathetic to the conspiracy angle of the JFK assassination, I think it's up to people like me, when you hear about how crazy Garrison was and what he was doing and how he ruined people's lives, to speak up and say something. And I really thank you for writing the book and drawing attention to this just really ill understood chapter of American history.
Yeah, thanks. It still boggles my mind, just the fact that there's so many defenders of Garrison out there who think that he was actually a hero.
So how did you go from researching the JFK assassination to kind of rejecting the whole conspiracy theory thing?
Well, I was a conspiracy theorist, and the good news for me was I started in the 1970s, but I became busy. I went to get my MBA at Queen's University at Kingston, and I sort of moved to Toronto, and I put it all away. I put all this stuff away. And when the House Select Committee on Assassinations final report came out, they accepted the single bullet theory. And I had always had trouble with the single bullet theory, but I was too busy to look into it. And I said, in the back of my mind, I really have to revisit this at some point to find out why they accepted it. And in the early 1990s, I moved to England, and I was living there, and somebody released the House Select Committee on Assassinations, their volumes of evidence, on a CD-ROM. And so I bought the CD-ROM, and I started going through it. And I was floored when I actually saw some real trajectory analysis diagrams done by NASA. And it all worked. It all was, everything worked. And I read the forensic pathology panel report, and what amazed me was the fact that they had done all these scientific tests, forensic, fingerprint, all these scientific tests, and every single test came back in support of a lone gunman. And that made a big impression on me, and that's when I started to change.
I guess just as a journalist, I'm naturally attracted to a theory or an explanation that has less moving parts. You know, if something can be something can be explained simply, as opposed to these books I have, various books I have on the JFK assassination, it's just loads and loads and loads and loads of data or information or factoids or tidbits that, like, I can't tell what it adds up to. I don't know who these geniuses are who can. Maybe the people who read the book or write the books are just that much more intelligent than I am. I don't know. But I mean, really, it just seems to prove that if you have 50 years and thousands of people and thousands of factoids, you can twist them around to explain anything ultimately.
Yeah, you can. And that's, you know, that's what conspiracy theorists do, is they latch on to all sorts of factoids, add them all together, put them together into some sort of false narrative.
So what went into your actually researching and writing this book? You know, you've uncovered a lot of documents that I think are being seen here for the first time.
I literally went to every single archive I could find in the United States that had primary Garrison documents. I mean, there are still two more archives I have not gone to. One is closed, and the other one is in Tennessee that I wanted to go to, but because of COVID, I couldn't get down there. But I went to everywhere I could find a Garrison document. I went. I made four trips to Washington. I went to Dallas twice. I went to New Orleans, and I got a ton of stuff, thousands and thousands of pages of Garrison documents. And that's why I wanted to include a lot of documents in my book, so people can actually see some of this stuff firsthand.
What do you got coming up next? Did you say you had another book that kind of builds off this one?
I think my next book will be the end of my trilogy on the JFK assassination. And it's what I want to do is go back into the 1960s and look at, start with all the early critics of the Warren Commission, Mark Lane, Harold Weisberg, Sylvia Marr, and look at how they misled the American population. My tentative title is We Were Misled. And it'll be sort of a social history of JFK conspiracy thinking to the present day. And I've got a ton of material for it already, and I've got some more archives to go to, and it's going to be a fun book.
Well, we will definitely keep our eyes out for it. And I'll just, you know, I'm very excited about the current book, and I really enjoyed talking to you. I would just say, you know, for anybody who's listening to this, that wherever you fall on the spectrum of, like, Kennedy, you know, assassination conspiracy or lone nut, like, you, Fred, you really just present so much important information and tell a really compelling story about what happens when, like, a crazy guy gets power and, you know, runs amok with it. And I think it's definitely well worth reading. So thanks for talking to me.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Failed State Update. I'm your host, Joseph L. Flatley. And yeah, if you want to see more of my stuff or reach out to me or complain at me, I can be reached through my website, LennyFlatley.net, or you can find me on Twitter, @LennyFlatley. And of course, all the links will be in the show notes.